Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going deep on a Supreme Court case, Groff v. DeJoy.
Oh, yeah, this is an interesting one.
It's a case that, you know, brings up that kind of tricky question. Like, what happens when you're, like, asked to do something at your job that goes against your, like, deeply held religious beliefs? You know, that's what happened to Gerald Groff. He was a devout evangelical Christian and also a mail carrier for the USPS. And for him, observing the Sabbath is, like, super important to his faith.
Right.
Which means, like, absolutely no work on Sundays.
Yeah, makes sense.
But, of course, you know, the world has changed a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone shops online, and Sunday deliveries are, like, totally normal now. So that put Groff in a really tough spot.
It's a classic class, and, you know, like, that age-old struggle to balance, you know, individual religious freedom with the demands of a modern workplace. I mean, what makes Groff's case so interesting is that it actually ended up in front of the Supreme Court, and it kind of forced them to take a fresh look at what undue hardship means for employers when it comes to religious accommodation.
So we've got a mail carrier who's not allowed to work Sundays, and then we've got the Postal Service, which, you know, has to deliver packages 7 days a week.
Right.
So what happened? Did Groff just refuse to work and get fired?
Not exactly, no. I mean, Groff definitely tried to find a solution.
You know.
He transferred to a smaller post office where Sunday work wasn't as frequent at first. And he even, like, volunteered to work other shifts that people didn't really want just to show how committed he was to his job.
Oh, wow.
But then the demand for Sunday deliveries just kept growing. And eventually he just ran out of options. He ended up facing, you know, disciplinary action for not showing up on Sundays. And he eventually resigned in 2019.
That's, wow. Talk about being stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? That must have been so stressful for him. So he sued the USPS.
He did. He sued under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Right.
Claiming that the USPS, you know, failed to reasonably accommodate his religious practice. And this is where things get kind of interesting from a legal standpoint. This whole case really boils down to how you interpret the phrase undue hardship. And that's been, like, this legal gray area for decades.
Oh, the legalese. All right. Now we're getting into the weeds a bit. So I know there's, like, a lot of legal precedent around religious accommodation in the workplace. Can you give us some background on that?
Sure. So the key case here, the one that kind of shaped this whole area of law, is the 1977 Hardison case.
Okay.
And this case essentially set up what's called a de minimis standard for employers. What that means is if accommodating an employee's religious practice would cause even, like, a tiny cost or burden to the employer, they could just say no to the request.
So basically, it was really easy for employers to claim undue hardship. Like, even if it was something small, like, say, the post office having to pay someone a few extra bucks in overtime to cover Groff's Sunday shift, that would be enough for them to deny his request.
Exactly. That's exactly what the lower courts leaned on when they initially ruled against Groff. They said, look, accommodating his Sunday Sabbath observance is just too much of a hardship for the USPS. However, when the case made its way up to the Supreme Court, they saw things a little differently. And that's where we get, like, the real turning point of the story.
Wait, so the Supreme Court actually overturned those lower court rulings?
They did.
And it was a unanimous decision.
Unanimous.
Okay, tell me more. What was their reasoning? Like, why?
So their decision was a big one. They basically said that this whole de minimis standard, which had been used for decades, was actually, like, a misinterpretation of what the Hardison case was really saying. They emphasized that undue hardship has to mean something more substantial, you know? It has to be a burden that's really excessive, truly unjustifiable for the employer to bear.
So what does that mean for employers now? Like, what's the new standard they need to meet when they're considering these religious accommodations?
Well, the court introduced a new test. It's called the substantial increased cost test.
Okay.
And now employers, they actually have to prove that accommodating an employee's religious practice would lead to a substantial increase in costs, specifically, you know, within their own business operations.
Substantial increased costs. Got it. But what does substantial even mean? How do you actually measure that?
Well, think of it this way. The word substantial implies something more than just, like, a minor inconvenience or a small increase in expenses.
Right.
It needs to be something big, something that would really impact the employer's business.
Okay, so, like, a small mom-and-pop shop might be able to prove substantial increased costs more easily than, say, a giant organization like the USPS.
Exactly.
Because, like, a few extra paid hours for another employee to cover, you know, wouldn't be a big deal for the USPS, but it might be a huge burden for a small business.
You got it. The court's acknowledging that what's considered substantial can really change depending on the employer's situation.
Okay.
It's all about proportionality. A small business might be able to show hardship much easier than a large corporation.
That makes sense. So now the burden of proof is really on the employer. right? They can't just say, oh, this will cost us a little more money or this is a bit inconvenient. They have to give real proof that accommodating the employee would actually hurt their business, either financially or operationally.
Exactly. It's all about raising the bar for employers. It's about making sure employees aren't forced to choose between their faith and keeping their jobs.
That's a big win for religious employees, right? But I bet this also raises a ton of questions about how it's actually going to be applied.
Oh, absolutely. This new test is going to lead to a lot of interesting legal battles as employers and employees try to figure out exactly where the line is.
We're really just scratching the surface here. There's so much more to talk about. But before we dive into all of that, I think it's important to take a step back and remember the human side of this whole thing. I mean, imagine having to choose between your faith and your job. It must have been incredibly stressful for Groff and other people in similar situations.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a really important point. Legal battles can often overshadow the personal stories at the heart of these cases.
Right.
And Groff's experience really reminds us that these cases aren't just about abstract legal principles. They're about real people grappling with incredibly tough choices. You know, it's about the right to live and work according to your deepest beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually brings us to another really fascinating part of this case. The Supreme Court didn't just redefine undue hardship. They also sent a pretty clear message about how important it is to build inclusive work environments.
Oh, okay. This is where it gets really interesting. What did the court say about inclusivity?
Well, they explicitly said that animosity towards religion just can't be used as an excuse to deny an accommodation.
Hmm.
They made it very clear that personal biases or, you know, just not liking certain religions or religious practices, that's not a legitimate reason to deny someone a reasonable accommodation.
So like if an employer said, look, we can't accommodate your religious practice because some of your coworkers might complain about having to cover your shifts, that wouldn't fly.
Exactly. The court emphasized that just coworkers grumbling, that's not enough. There has to be a real, tangible impact on the business itself. Think about it. If just coworker complaints were enough to deny an accommodation, it would basically give anyone who has biases against a certain religion the power to veto any accommodation. And that's definitely not what Title VIII is about.
So what would be a legitimate reason for an employer to deny an accommodation, you know, based on how it would affect coworkers?
Well, the court actually gave a few examples. Imagine, like, a situation where accommodating an employee's religious practice ends up causing a bunch of other employees to quit because they suddenly have way too much work.
Okay, yeah.
Or maybe there's a noticeable drop in productivity because the workflow gets totally messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Those are real, tangible impacts on the business, and those could potentially be enough to meet that substantial increased costs test.
So it's not just about people's feelings of, you know, being annoyed or inconvenienced. It has to be about objective proof that the accommodation is actually messing with the way the business runs.
Exactly. And that's what makes this new standard so interesting, but also so challenging. It requires a really nuanced look at the specific facts of each case.
This seems like it could get really tricky to apply in real life. Imagine being an HR person or a manager trying to figure all this out. It's a lot to wrap your head around.
It definitely is. The ruling gives a basic framework, but there's still a lot of room for different interpretations, and that's going to create a lot of uncertainty for both employers and employees. It's kind of fascinating, actually, how the Supreme Court came to this new standard. They didn't just focus on the Hardison case by itself. They went way back, you know, back to the very foundation of Title VII,
okay,
looking at its legislative history, trying to understand the original thinking behind those religious accommodation rules.
So they were taking the long view, huh? Trying to grasp the whole spirit purpose of the law. Not just, you know, zeroing in on one specific case.
Exactly. And what's really interesting is they found that this whole de minimis interpretation, it didn't actually line up with what Title VII was originally supposed to do, which is, you know, protect people from religious discrimination at work. I mean, you got to remember, this law was passed during the civil rights era. It was a time of massive social change, a real push for equal rights for everybody.
So it's like the court was saying, hey, this de minimis standard has strayed too far from what Title VIII was meant to do. It's not about letting employers off the hook for the smallest inconvenience.
That's a great way to put it, yeah. They really stress that Title VIII requires employers to reasonably accommodate an employee's religious practices unless it would cause undue hardship to the employer's business, and they wanted to make sure those words were given their full weight, you know?
Okay, but let's be real. Terms like reasonably accommodate and undue hardship, they still sound pretty open to interpretation. Like, what exactly did the court say about how we should understand those terms?
Well, they emphasized that undue hardship should be understood in a plain, common sense way. It's a hardship that's really excessive or unjustifiable, considering the specific context of the employer's business.
So not just like any minor inconvenience or having to add a couple extra dollars to the payroll.
Exactly. They wanted to move away from this idea that any little cost or burden on the employer was a good enough reason to deny someone's religious accommodation. They argued that Congress, when they created Title VII, they clearly intended to protect religious employees from having to choose between their faith and their jobs.
This ruling really feels like a major victory for religious freedom at work. Like the court is saying, hey, employers, you got to step up and do more to accommodate your employees' religious beliefs and practices.
Yeah, it definitely strengthens the rights of religious employees, and it raises the bar for employers. They can't get away with using these tiny inconveniences or budget concerns as excuses anymore.
Right.
They really need to show a significant burden on their business.
You know, as we're talking about this, it reminds me a lot of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA.
Uh-huh.
That law also says employers have to make reasonable accommodations for employees with disabilities unless doing so would cause an undue hardship. The wording and the whole idea behind both laws seem pretty similar.
That's a sharp observation. There definitely are parallels between the ADA and Title VII in terms of how they're worded and the general principles behind them. Both laws are about protecting people from discrimination and making sure they have equal opportunities in the workplace. In fact, some legal experts have even argued that the undue hardship standard should be interpreted the same way for both laws. But in this case, the Supreme Court actually made a distinction.
Oh, really? Why would they decide to treat religious accommodations differently?
Well, they acknowledge that there are similarities, but they ultimately said that the history of Title VII and the way its religious accommodation rules are written suggest a separate and possibly stricter standard for undue hardship when it comes to religious freedom.
Interesting. So while there are connections to the ADA, the court is saying that religious accommodations need to be looked at on their own, potentially with a tougher standard for undue hardship.
Exactly. It's subtle, but it's important. It's a recognition that religious beliefs and practices are unique, and they need strong protection in the workplace. The court is essentially saying that religion has a special place in our society and deserves to be protected more vigorously.
Okay, we've talked a lot about the whole substantial increased costs standard, but what other things will courts look at when they're deciding if an employer has met that undue hardship bar?
The Supreme Court was pretty clear that it's a case-by-case thing. Lower courts have to take into account the type of business, its size, its operating costs, the specific accommodation that's being requested, and the practical effects of that accommodation on how the business actually runs.
So there's no simple formula, right?
Right.
What might be a huge hardship for a small business with limited resources might be no big deal for a giant company that has more flexibility.
Exactly. It's all about context. The court wants those lower courts to really dig into the specifics of each case. You know, look at the employer's unique situation and weigh the accommodation request against those circumstances.
Right.
It's about finding a fair balance.
The court also talked about the impact on coworkers, didn't they? That seems like a tricky area, especially when you're talking about scheduling and covering shifts.
Yeah, they said that coworker impacts can be a factor, but only if they actually affect how the business operates. So, like, if some coworkers are grumbling about having to cover someone's Sunday shifts because of a religious accommodation, that by itself isn't undue hardship.
But what happens if those complaints turn into something bigger, like people threatening to quit or actually quitting?
That's where things get a little fuzzy. If coworker unhappiness leads to a real measurable impact on the business, like a ton of people quitting or a big drop in productivity, then that might be considered an undue hardship. But remember, it can't just be hypothetical.
Right.
The employer has to provide actual evidence that the accommodation is causing those problems.
So it's not about subjective feelings. It's about objective proof that the accommodation is actually disrupting the business.
Precisely. And that's what makes this new standard so interesting, but also so difficult. It requires a really close look at the facts of each case.
This seems like it could be really tough to apply in the real world. Imagine you're an HR professional or a manager trying to figure all this out. It's a lot to wrap your head around.
Oh, for sure. This ruling sets some guidelines, but there's a lot open to interpretation. And that's going to create a lot of uncertainty for both employers and employees as we go forward.
It feels like this ruling, you know, it could have effects way beyond just religious accommodations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, could this case actually set a precedent for how courts interpret undue hardship in other areas of employment law?
Yeah, that's definitely possible. The court specifically said that their decision only applied to religious accommodations under Title Acony, but it's hard to imagine that it won't have some influence on how courts look at similar language in other laws, legal precedents, they have a way of, you know, spreading out.
Right, they totally do. So could we start seeing the employees who are seeking accommodations for disabilities or family responsibilities? Could they start using similar arguments, you know, pushing for a more employee-friendly interpretation of undue hardship across the board?
I wouldn't be surprised at all to see those arguments gaining traction. The core principle is the same, right?
Yeah.
Employers should have to make reasonable adjustments for their employees unless it would truly put a huge burden on their business. Whether it's about religious practices, disabilities, or taking care of family, it's all about recognizing that employees have lives and commitments outside of work.
This could be a real turning point for workplace rights, you know, a shift toward more flexibility and understanding from employers. It makes you wonder if this case could spark a bigger conversation about how work is changing and the need for more inclusive and accommodating workplaces overall.
It's a conversation we definitely need to be having. As society changes, workplaces have to adapt too. This case really highlights the tension that's growing between the traditional way we think about work and the needs of a diverse, modern workforce.
So let's step back for a second and think big picture. What's the bottom line for employers? What are the key things they need to remember after this decision?
I think the biggest takeaway is that the legal rules have changed. Employers have to move on from that old de minimis way of thinking and start taking a more thoughtful, thorough approach to religious accommodation requests.
Okay.
It's not just about checking off boxes anymore.
Right.
It's about creating a work culture where religious diversity is valued and respected.
So being proactive is really important, right? Instead of waiting for requests to come in and then scrambling to figure things out, employers need to be thinking ahead, anticipating needs, and creating policies that are inclusive from the very beginning.
You got it. Review those policies, train your staff, and build a culture of inclusivity. Make it clear to your employees that you're willing to work with them to find solutions that respect their religious beliefs and practices while putting their jobs at risk.
It seems like open communication and a willingness to collaborate are key here. When both sides are ready to listen and find common ground, it's much easier to find solutions that work for everyone.
Absolutely. This isn't about being adversarial. It's about building trust and understanding. When employers and employees work together, they can create workplaces that are both productive and inclusive.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. We've broken down the legal ins and outs of this case, talked about its potential impact, and even touched on some broader trends in society. It's been a really interesting deep dive.
It really has. The Graf v. DeJoy decision is a landmark ruling, and it brings up some important questions about religious freedom, workers' rights, and how the very nature of work is changing.
It's a case that people will definitely keep debating and analyzing for years to come. And like we've talked about, its effects could go far beyond just religious accommodations. It could change how we think about inclusivity in the workplace in a much broader sense.
It's a good reminder that the law is always changing, always adapting to the realities of our society. As we move forward, it's crucial to stay informed, have these important conversations, and work towards creating workplaces that are fair, just, and inclusive for absolutely everyone.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Graf v. DeJoy case. We hope this conversation has given you some valuable insights and made you think about some important questions. Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep diving deep into the issues that matter most.